History is often written by the men who stood on the crates, but it was built by the women who stood in the gaps. In the early 1900s, the Caribbean was a pressure cooker. Colonial masters held the lid down tight while the global economy crumbled. When the explosions finally came in the 1930s, the names recorded in the ledgers of rebellion were almost entirely male. But behind the strikes, the marches, and the sudden violent shifts in power, there was a quiet domestic machinery at work. These were the women who organized in kitchens, laundries, and markets. They were nursing leaders like Nita Barrow and organizers like Elma Francois. They did not just want a seat at the table. They wanted to flip the table over. Today we look at the quiet revolutions. We look at the names history tried to erase, and we ask why the loudest voices are the only ones we chose to remember. Chapter 1. The Domestic Front. The year is 1937. In Barbados, the air is thick with more than just the scent of cut cane. It is heavy with the weight of a dying colonial order. Most history books will tell you about the men who led the riots. They will speak of Grantley Adams and the birth of the labor unions. But they rarely speak about the nurses. They rarely speak about the women who saw the malnutrition and the disease in the villages long before the first stone was thrown. Nita Barrow was not a woman who waited for permission. In the 1930s, nursing was one of the few avenues for a black woman to gain a foothold in the professional world, but it was a world designed to keep her subservient. The hospitals were segregated. The resources were slim. The colonial authorities saw nursing as a form of domestic service with a medical title. Nita Barrow saw it as a front line. Our history likes to paint revolution as a series of loud speeches and street fights. But in the early 1900s, revolution started in the kitchen. It started in the nursing quarters. These were the only places where black women could gather without drawing the immediate suspicion of the colonial police. While the men were being watched in the fields and on the docks, the women were sharing information across the clotheslines and over the stoves. Nita Barrow began to organize. She did not call it a rebellion. She called it professionalization. She pushed for better training, better pay, and better conditions for the women who held the health of the island in their hands. But the subtext was clear. By organizing the nurses, she was organizing a network of educated, mobile, and respected women who could move through every layer of Barbadian society. The colonial government did not see the threat. They viewed these women through the lens of erasure. To the British governors, a nurse was a background character. She was someone who cleaned up the mess after the history was made. They did not realize that by ignoring these women, they were giving them the perfect cover to build a new social consciousness. When the 1937 labor rebellions finally tore through Bridgetown, the infrastructure of care was already in place. The women were not just bystanders. They were the ones who managed the fallout. They were the ones who knew exactly how many families were starving and exactly how much pressure the system could take before it snapped. We have to understand that for a woman in 1900, the simple act of demanding a fair wage was an act of war. The law did not recognize them as independent economic actors. In many cases, their earnings were legally the property of their husbands or fathers. Every cent Nita Barrow fought for was a cent stolen back from a system that demanded their total invisibility. The kitchen was the war room. In the small wooden houses across the Caribbean, women were the primary communicators. They moved between the grand houses of the white elite and the crowded barracks of the poor. They heard the secrets of the masters and the grievances of the laborers. They were the intelligence officers of a revolution that had not yet found its name. This was not a revolution of guns. It was a revolution of presence. It was the refusal to be silent in the face of a system that calculated their worth only in terms of how much labor could be extracted from their bodies. Nita Barrow's work in the 1930s laid the groundwork for a health system that would eventually serve a free nation, but at the time, it was a desperate struggle for basic dignity. The pressure was mounting. By the mid-30s, the sugar prices had collapsed. The men who had traveled to work on the Panama Canal were returning home to islands that had no work for them. The social fabric was fraying at the edges. The colonial authorities increased their surveillance, but they continued to look in the wrong places. They watched the docks. They watched the rum shops. They did not watch the clinics. They did not see the way the nurses were talking to the mothers. They did not see the way the market women were coordinating prices to keep the community fed, while the official economy burned. This was a quiet revolution, fueled by the daily indignity of being treated as a ghost in your own home. But a ghost can be a dangerous thing when it decides to speak. As the decade drew to a close, the silence in the kitchens and the clinics began to sharpen into something else. The women of the Caribbean were no longer just holding the line. They were preparing to cross it. The domestic front was about to spill out into the streets, and the colonial masters were about to learn that you cannot erase a fire once it has already started to spread. The question was no longer if the system would break. The question was who would be left to pick up the pieces when it did. The men were ready to fight, but the women were already planning for what came after the fight. They were looking at the long game. They were looking at a Caribbean that did not yet exist. As the sun set on the 1930s, the quiet was finally replaced by the sound of boots on the pavement and voices raised in the square. The domestic front had done its job. The foundation was set. Now the revolution was moving into the light of day, and it was moving with a force that no ledger or history book could ever fully contain. The first stone was about to be thrown, but the hand that held it had been strengthened by years of quiet, steady resistance in the shadows. There is a cost to being the one who waits. There is a price for being the one who organizes while others sleep. For the women of 1937, that price was about to be called in. The riots were coming. Chapter 2. The Market and the Street. In Trinidad, the revolution did not wear a suit. It wore an apron and carried a basket. While the official records focus on the oil field riots of 1937 and the rise of Uriah Butler, the engine of the resistance was fueled by the Negro Welfare Cultural and Social Association. At the center of that engine was Elma Francois. Elma Francois was not interested in quiet reform. She was a laborer, a migrant from St. Vincent, and a woman who understood that in the Caribbean, the market was the heart of the community. In the early 1900s, the Port of Spain markets were more than just places to buy yams and saltfish. They were the central nervous system of the working class. Information moved through the stalls faster than the colonial authorities could track it. The year was 1935. The global economy was a wreckage. In Trinidad, the working poor were being squeezed until they bled. Wages were stagnant, but the cost of basic food was skyrocketing. Elma Francois saw that the men in the unions were focused on the workplace, but the women were the ones who had to deal with the reality of an empty pot. She realized that if you want to stop a colony, you don't just stop the machines, you stop the stomach. She organized the Hunger March of 1935. This was not a polite request for a meeting with the governor. It was a direct confrontation with the power structure. Elma led hundreds of people through the streets of Port of Spain, demanding bread, work, and the right to exist without the constant threat of starvation. Our history often treats these marches as spontaneous outbursts of anger. They were not. They were calculated tactical maneuvers. Elma and her comrades in the NWCSA were teaching the people how to organize. They were holding meetings in the back of shops and in the middle of crowded streets. They were talking about the war in Ethiopia and the rise of fascism in Europe. They were connecting the struggle of the Trinidadian market woman to the global struggle against oppression. The colonial police were baffled. They were trained to deal with dock workers and cane cutters. They knew how to handle a group of angry men. But when Elma Francois stood before them, she didn't use a weapon. She used the truth. She used her voice to expose the hypocrisy of a British empire that claimed to bring civilization while its subjects lived in huts with dirt floors. When the men were arrested, when the leaders were thrown into the royal gaol, it was the women who kept the pulse beating. They were the ones who collected the pennies to pay for legal fees. They were the ones who printed the pamphlets and distributed them under the cover of night. While the colonial administration thought they had decapitated the movement by jailing the men, the women were simply widening the base. Elma Francois was eventually charged with sedition. She was the first woman in the history of Trinidad and Tobago to be tried for such a crime. In the courtroom, she did not cower. She turned her defense into a political lecture. She told the judge and the jury that she was not the one who was seditious. She argued that the government was seditious because it worked against the welfare of the people it was supposed to protect. She spoke for the women who worked 18 hours a day for a pittance. She spoke for the mothers who had to watch their children grow thin because the sugar estates wanted higher profits. She was a direct threat to the colonial order because she refused to accept the domestic box they had built for her. The street was her territory. In the 1930s, for a black woman to occupy the public square and demand political power was a radical act. It broke every social norm of the British Caribbean. The authorities tried to paint her as an agitator, a foreign element, or a madwoman. They tried to use her gender to discredit her intellect. They failed. The hunger did not go away, but the fear did. Because of the work of women like Elma, the people realized that the colonial masters were not invincible. They saw that the police could be defied. They saw that the market could be a site of resistance just as much as the oil field. But the street is a dangerous place for those who seek to change the world. The state has a long memory and a heavy hand. While Elma Francois was winning the intellectual battle in the courts, the physical toll of the struggle was mounting. The surveillance was constant. The pressure on her family and her health was unrelenting. The resistance was shifting. The quiet revolutions of the kitchens were now the loud rebellions of the streets. The women had moved from the background to the front line, and there was no going back. They had proven that the survival of the community was a political act. But as the 1930s closed and the world prepared for another great war, a new threat emerged. It wasn't just the police or the governors. It was the pen of the historian. Even as these women were making history, the machinery was being prepared to write them out of it. The men were getting ready to take the credit. The commissions were being formed to study the unrest, and they were already deciding whose names would be remembered and whose would be dropped into the margins. Elma Francois had held the street. She had faced the judge. She had kept the movement alive when the lights went out. But the hardest battle was yet to come. It was the battle against being forgotten. The ledgers were being opened. The ink was drying. And the women who had led the charge were about to find out exactly how much the establishment hated a woman who knew her own power. The silence was returning. But this time, it was being forced. Chapter 3. The Price of Silence. By 1938, the Caribbean was no longer a collection of sleepy colonies. It was a region in open revolt. The British government, panicked by the scale of the violence and the collapse of order, dispatched the Moyne Commission. This group of officials was tasked with investigating the disturbances and figuring out how to fix a broken system. But as the commissioners sat in their wood-paneled rooms and took their notes, a second crime was being committed, the crime of erasure. The Moyne Commission's report is hundreds of pages long. It lists grievances. It details poverty. It mentions the unrest of the men in the fields and the mines. But the names of the women who organized the marches, the nurses who ran the clandestine networks, and the market women who held the economy together are missing. To the British Empire, history was something made by men in hats. The women were merely part of the scenery. This erasure was not an accident. It was a strategy. If the colonial government acknowledged that black women were the intellectual and organizational backbone of the resistance, they would have to acknowledge a level of social sophistication they weren't prepared to handle. It was easier to frame the rebellions as riots caused by hot-headed men than to admit they were facing a total social uprising led by the very people they considered the most invisible. In the decades that followed the 1930s, this silence became institutionalized. As the Caribbean moved toward independence in the 50s and 60s, the founding fathers took the stage. The monuments were built to the men who signed the treaties and gave the speeches. Nita Barrow's work was categorized as social service rather than political warfare. Elma Francois was remembered in small circles, but her name did not appear in the standard school curriculum. Our history has been scrubbed of the feminine pulse that made liberation possible. When we look at the 1900s, we are taught to see a male-dominated struggle. We are taught that the women were the supporters, the cooks, and the caregivers. We are not taught that they were the strategists, who understood that true power is not found in the barrel of a gun, but in the control of the community's resources. The cost of this silence is high. When you remove women from the history of resistance, you create a false narrative of how change happens. You make it seem as though freedom is a gift handed down by great men, rather than a hard-won victory built from the ground up by ordinary people. You teach future generations that the kitchen and the clinic are not political spaces, when in reality, they were the birthplaces of our sovereignty. In the 1980s, long after the fires of the 30s had cooled, Nita Barrow finally received international recognition, eventually serving as the Governor General of Barbados. But for every Nita Barrow, there are 1,000 women whose names have been lost to the damp heat and the turning pages of history. There are the women of the St. Kitts sugar strikes, who faced the police with nothing but their voices. There are the laundry workers in Jamaica, who organized for better pay, while the world looked the other way. We have to ask ourselves, who does it serve to keep these women in the shadows? It serves the status quo. It serves the idea that leadership is a masculine trait, and that the domestic sphere is a place of compliance. By reclaiming these stories, we are not just adding names to a list. We are correcting a fundamental error in our understanding of power. Today, the legacy of these quiet revolutions lives on in the informal economies of the Caribbean. It lives in the higgler and the tray woman, who still command the markets of Kingston and Port of Spain. It lives in the nurses who continue to be the backbone of our social fabric. These women are the direct descendants of a resistance that refused to be loud until it was too late for the masters to stop it. The erasure is not permanent. History is not just what is written in the books, it is what we choose to remember and what we choose to speak into the air. The quiet revolutions were only quiet because the world refused to listen. But the ground they cleared is the ground we stand on today. Our history is a full circle. The struggle for dignity that began in the kitchens of 1900 continues in the boardrooms and the streets of today. The names may change, but the strategy remains the same. Organize the unorganized, center the community, and never ever let them tell you that your work does not matter. We honor the architects of our freedom by speaking their names. Nita Barrow, Elma Francois, the nameless thousands who stood in the gap. They were never just background characters. They were the lead actors in a drama that the world was too small to understand. The price of silence was paid in the 20th century. In the 21st, we are calling in the dead. The ghosts are speaking. And this time, we are finally ready to hear what they have to say. The blueprint for our future was drawn in the shadows of our past. It is time we turned on the lights. This is our history. This is our truth. And the silence is finally over.